yelling and shooting and dying, their fates already written when the world began, but Lacey was in that place no more. For as Carter placed his mouth upon her neck, calling the soft beat of her heart to his own, she felt it. All his pain and puzzlement, and the long, sad story of who he was. The bed of rags and bundles under the roadway, and the sweat and soil of his skin and of his long journey. The great gleaming car stopping beside him with its grill of jeweled teeth, and the voice of the woman calling out to him over the dirty roar of the world. The sweetness of mown grass and the sweating coolness of a glass of tea. The pull of the water and the arms of the woman, Rachel Wood, holding fast, pulling him down and down. It was his life that Lacey felt inside her, his little human life, which he had never loved as much as he loved the woman whose spirit he now carried inside him. For Lacey felt that also, and as his teeth cut into the soft curve of her neck, filling Lacey's senses with the heat of his breath, she heard her own voice rising, bubbling past. "God bless you. God bless and keep you, Mr. Carter." Then he was gone. She was lying on the ground, bleeding, time passing, the sickness starting. That which was to pass between them had found its way, she knew. Lacey closed her eyes and prayed for a sign, but no sign came. As it had been in the field after the men had left her when she was just a girl. It seemed in that dark hour that God had forgotten about her. But then as dawn opened the sky above her face, from out of the stillness came the figure of a man. She could hear the soft tread of his steps upon the earth, could smell the smoke of his skin and hair. She tried to speak, but couldn't. Neither did the man address her, nor tell her his name. In silence he lifted her into his arms, cradling her like a child, and Lacey thought that it was God himself come to take her to his home in heaven. His eyes were hooded in shadow. His hair was a dark corona, wild and beautiful, like his beard, a dense mass of gray upon his face. He carried her through the smoking ruins, and she saw that he was weeping. "Those are God's own tears," Lacey thought, yearning to reach out and touch them. It had never occurred to her that God would cry, but of course that was wrong. God would be crying all the time. He would cry and cry and never stop. An exhausted peacefulness swept through her. For a time she slept. She did not recall what happened next, but when it was over and the sickness had passed, she opened her eyes and knew that he had done it. He had saved her. She had found the way to Amy. She had found the way at last. "Lacey," she heard. "Listen." She did. She listened. The voices moved over her like a breeze on water, like a current in the blood, everywhere and all around. "Hear them, Lacey. Hear them all." And so it was that through the years she'd waited. She, Sister Lacey Antoinette Kudoto, and the man who had carried her through the forest, who was not God after all, but human, a human being. The good doctor. For that was how she thought of him. That was the name she used in her mind, though his given name, his Christian name, was Jonas. Jonas Lear, the saddest man in all the world. Together they had built the house in the glen where Lacey lived still. Not much larger than the shacks she recalled from the dusty roads and red clay fields of her youth, but sturdier and made to last. The doctor once told her that he had built a house before, a cabin on a lake in the woods of Maine, that he had built this cabin with Elizabeth, his wife who had died, he did not say, but he did not have to. The abandoned compound was a bounty waiting to be harvested. They had taken the lumber from the burnt remains of the chalet. In the storage buildings they found hammers and saws and planes and sacks of nails, as well as sacks of concrete and a mixer to pour the posts that would serve as the cabin's foundation and to mortar the fieldstones that the two of them lifted into place to build the hearth. For one whole summer they stripped roofing shingles off the old barracks, only to find that they leaked, the asphalt torn in too many places. In the end, they piled sod on top, making a roof of dirt and grass. There were guns, too, guns by the hundreds, guns of every sort and nature. It was not easy getting rid of so many guns. For a period of time, that was how they occupied themselves, dismantling the soldiers' guns until all that remained was a vast mound of nuts and bolts and glossy metal pieces, not even worth burying. He left her only one time, their third summer on the mountain, to go in search of seeds. He took the one gun he had kept, a rifle, with the food and fuel and other supplies he would need, all packed in the pickup that he had prepared for his journey. 3 days, he said. But 2 whole weeks had come and gone before Lacey heard the sound of the pickup's engine driving up the mountain. He emerged from the cab wearing a look of such despair she knew it was only his pledge to return that had brought him back to her. He'd driven as far as Grand Junction, he confessed, before deciding to turn around. In the truck were the promised packs of seeds. That night he lit the hearth and sat by it in a terrible, desolated silence, staring into the flames. Never had she seen such pain in a man's eyes, and although she knew she could not lift this grief from him, it was that same night she went to him and said she believed that they should live together from that day forward as man and wife, in every respect. It seemed a small thing to offer him this love, this taste of forgiveness. And when this came about, as it did in due course, she understood that the love she had tendered was also love sought. An end to the journey she had begun in the fields of her childhood all those years ago. He never left again. Through the years she loved him with her body, which did not age as he did. She loved him and he loved her, each in their way, the two of them alone together on their mountain. Death came to him slowly over the years, first one thing and then another, nibbling away at the edges, then moving deeper. His eyes and hair, his teeth and skin, his legs and heart and lungs. There were many days when Lacey wished she could die also, so that he would not have to make this final voyage alone. One morning she was working in the garden when she felt his absence. She went into the house, then into the woods, calling his name. It was high summer, the air fresh and bright, falling over the leaves like drizzled sunlight. He had chosen a place where the trees were thin and the sky was all above. From here he could see the valley and, beyond it, like a great becalmed sea, the wave-like mountains receding to a blue horizon. He was leaning on a shovel, panting for breath. He was an old man now, gray and frail, and yet here he was, digging a hole in the earth. "What is that hole?" she asked him, and he told her, "It's for me, so that when I'm gone you won't have to dig it yourself. It wouldn't do in summer to have to wait to dig a hole." All that day and into the evening he dug, moving small shovels of earth, pausing after each for breath. She watched from the edge of the clearing, for he would have no help from her. And when he was done, the hole having reached a satisfactory dimension, he returned to the house where they had lived so many years together, to the bed he had built with his own hands from heavy joined timbers and lengths of fibrous rope that sagged with the shape of the two of them, and in the morning was dead. How long ago? Lacey paused in her telling, Amy's and the young man's eyes, Peter's eyes watching her from across the room. How strange, after so much time, to tell these stories of Jonas and that terrible night and all that had happened in this place. She had stoked the fire and set a pot in the cradle to warm. The air of the house, two low-ceilinged rooms separated by a curtain, was warm and fragrant, lit by the glow of the fire. 54 years, she said, answering the question she herself had posed. She said it again to herself. 54 years since Jonas had left her alone. She stirred the pot, which contained a stew of this and that, the meat of a fat possum from her trapline and hardy vegetables, the durable tubers which she had put away for winter. Sitting in jars upon the shelves were the seeds she used each year, the descendants of the ones Jonas had brought in the packets. Zucchini and tomatoes, potatoes and squash, onions and turnips and lettuce. Her needs were small. The cold did not affect her, and she sometimes barely ate for days or even weeks. But Peter would be hungry. He was just as she'd imagined, young and strong, with a determined face, though she'd thought somehow that he would be taller. She became aware that he was frowning at her. "You've been by yourself. For 50 years." She shrugged. "It was really not so long." "And you set the beacon." The beacon. She had almost forgotten. But of course he would ask about this. "Oh, it was the doctor who did that." It made Lacey miss him keenly to speak this way. She broke her gaze away and turned from her stirring, wiping her hands on a cloth and taking up bowls from the table. Such things. He was always tinkering. "But there will be time for more talk. Now, we eat." She served them the stew. She was glad to see Peter eating heartily, though Amy, she could tell, was just pretending. Lacey herself possessed no appetite at all. Whenever it was time for her to eat, Lacey felt not hunger, but a mild curiosity, her mind remarking to her in an offhand way, as if to comment on nothing more important than the weather or the time of day, "It would be good to eat now." She sat and watched him with a feeling of gratitude. Outside, the dark night pressed down upon the mountain. She did not know if she would ever see another. Soon she would be free. When they were done, she rose from the table and went to the bedroom. The small space was sparsely furnished, just the bed the doctor had made and a dresser where she kept the few things she needed. The boxes were under the bed. Peter stood in the curtained doorway, observing silently as she knelt and drew them out onto the floor. A pair of army lockers. At one time they had contained guns. Amy was behind him now, watching with curious eyes. "Help me carry these to the kitchen," she said. How many years she had imagined this moment. They placed them on the floor by the table. Lacey knelt once more and undid the hasps of the first locker, the one she'd kept for Amy. Inside was Amy's knapsack, which she'd worn to the convent. The Powerpuff Girls. "This is yours," she said, and placed it on the table. For a moment, the girls simply stared at it. Then, with deliberate care, she drew back the zipper and withdrew the contents. A toothbrush. A tiny shirt, limp with age, with the word "Sassy" written on it in glittering flakes. A pair of threadbare jeans. And at the bottom, a stuffed rabbit of tan velveteen wearing a pale blue jacket. The fabric was crumbling away. One of his ears was gone, exposing a curl of wire. "It was Sister Claire who bought the shirt for you," Lacey said. "I do not think Sister Arnett approved of it." Amy had put the other objects aside on the table and was holding the rabbit in her hands, peering into its face. "Your sisters," Amy said. "But not actual sisters." Lacey took a chair before her. "That is right, Amy. That is what I said to you." "We are sisters in the eyes of God." Amy dropped her gaze again. With her thumb, she stroked the fabric of the rabbit. "He brought him to me. In the sick room. I remember his voice telling me to wake up. But I couldn't answer him." Lacey was aware of Peter's eyes, intently watching.
"Who did, Amy?" she asked.
"Walgast." Her voice was distant, lost in the past. "He told me about Eva."
"Eva?"
"She died. He would have given her his heart." The girl met Lacey's gaze again, squinting intently.
"You were there, too. I remember now."
"Yes,
I was."
"And another man."
Lacey nodded.
"Agent Doyle."
Amy frowned sharply. "I didn't like him. He thought I did, but I didn't." She closed her eyes, remembering.
"We were in the car.
We were in the car, but then we stopped." She opened her eyes.
"You were bleeding."
"Why were you bleeding?" Lacey had almost forgotten. After everything else, it had come to seem so small, this part of the story.
"To tell you the truth, I did not know myself. But I think that one of the soldiers must have shot me."
"You got out of the car. Why did you do that?"
"To be here for you, Amy," she answered. "So someone would be here when you came back."
Another silence passed, the girl worrying the rabbit with her fingers like a talisman.
"They're so sad. They have such terrible dreams. I hear them all the time."
"What do you hear, Amy?"
"Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? They ask and ask, but I can't tell them."
Lacey cupped the girl's chin. Her eyes were glistening with tears.
"You will. When the time is right." "They're dying, Lacey. They're dying and can't stop. Why can't they stop, Lacey?" "I think that they are waiting for you, to show them the way."
They stayed that way a long moment. In the place where Lacey's mind met Amy's, she felt her sorrow and her loneliness, but even more, she felt her courage. She turned to Peter then. He did not love Amy as Walgast had. She could see that there was another, someone he had left behind. But he was the one who had answered the beacon. Whoever heard it and brought Amy back, he would be the one to stand with her. She bent to the second locker on the floor. Stacked inside were manila folders of yellowed paper, still, after so many years, exuding a faint odor of smoke. It was the doctor who had retrieved them, along with Amy's backpack, as the fires had moved down through the underground levels of the chalet. "Someone should know," he had said. She withdrew the first file and placed it on the table before him. The label read, X-ORD-13292-TS1-EYES-ONLY, via Walgast, Bradford J, intake profile CT3, subject 1, Babcock, Giles J.
"It is time for you to learn how this world was made," said Sister Lacey.
And then she opened it. Chapter 66. They rode through the fading day, a party of five, Alicia on point. The trail of the many was a broad swath of destruction, the snow trampled, branches broken, the ground littered with debris. It seemed to grow denser and wider with every kilometer, as if more of the creatures were joining the pod, called out of the wilderness to take their place among their kind. Here and there they saw a stain of blood on the snow where a hapless animal, a deer or rabbit or squirrel, had met its swift demise. The tracks were less than 12 hours old. Somewhere up ahead, in the shade of the trees and under the rocky ledges and perhaps even beneath the snow itself, they waited, dozing the day away, a great pod of virals, thousands strong. By late afternoon, they were forced to make a decision. To follow the creature's trail, the shortest route up the mountain, but one that would take them right into the heart of the pod. Or to turn north, find the river again, and make their approach from the west. Michael watched from atop his horse as Alicia and Greer conferred. Hollis and Sarah were beside him, their rifles resting across their laps, their parkas zipped to their chins. The air was bitterly cold. In the immense stillness, every sound seemed magnified, the wind like a rush of static over the frozen land. "We go north," Alicia announced. "All eyes." There had been no discussion about who would come. The only surprise was Greer. As the four of them had been mounting up to leave, he had come forward on his horse and joined their number without a word of explanation, passing his command to Eustace. Michael wondered if this meant Greer would be in charge, but as soon as they were clear of the ridge, the major turned to Alicia from atop his horse and said simply, "This is your show, Lieutenant." "Are we clear, everyone?" They all said they were, and that was that. They rode on. As night was falling, Michael heard from up ahead the bright notes of the river. They emerged from the woods onto its southern bank and turned east, using it to guide them through the thickening dark. They had closed up to a single line now, Alicia up front, Greer taking the rear. From time to time, one of the horses would stumble, or Alicia would pull up, signaling for them to hold and listening intently, scanning the dark shape of the trees. Then they'd press on again. No one had spoken for hours. There was no moon at all. Then, as a sliver of light lifted from the hills, the valley opened around them. To the east they could discern the shape of the mountain, pressed against a starry sky, and up ahead, some kind of structure, a brooding black shape that, as they approached, revealed itself as a bridge, standing astride the ice-choked river on concrete piers. Alicia dismounted and knelt to the ground. "Two sets of footprints," she said, gesturing with her rifle. "Over the bridge, from the far side." They began to climb. It was not much later that they found the horse. With a tight nod, Greer confirmed that it was his, the gelding Peter and Amy had taken. They all dismounted and stood around the dead animal. Its throat was ripped open in a bright splash, its body stiff and shriveled where it lay on its side in the snow. Somehow it had gotten across the river, probably fording at a shallow spot. They could see the prints of its last terrified gallop coming from the west. Sarah knelt and touched the animal's side. "He's still warm," she said. No one said anything. Dawn would come soon. To the east, the sky had begun to pale. Chapter 67. They were criminals. By the time Peter put down the last file, rubbing his bleary eyes, the night was nearly done. Amy had long since fallen asleep, curled on the bed beneath a blanket. Lacey had moved a chair from the kitchen to sit beside her. From time to time, as he'd turned the pages, rising to put one file back in the box and remove the next, piecing the story together as best he could, he'd heard Amy muttering softly in her sleep behind the curtain. For a while, after Amy had gone to bed, Lacey had sat with him at the table, explaining the things he couldn't make sense of on his own. The files were thick, full of information that referred to a world he didn't know, had never seen or lived in.
But still, over the hours, with Lacey's help, the story had emerged in his mind. There were photographs, too. Grown men with puffy, lived-in faces, their eyes glazed and unfocused. Some were holding a board of writing to their chests or wearing it like a necklace. Texas Department of Criminal Justice, one board read. Louisiana State Department of Corrections, said another. Kentucky and Florida and Wyoming and Delaware. Some of the boards had no words on them, only numbers. Some of the men had no boards at all. They were black and white and brown, heavy or slight. Somehow, in the looks of numb surrender on their faces, they were all the same. He read, Subject 12, Carter Anthony L., born September 12, 1985, Baytown, Texas. Sentenced to death for capital murder, Harris County, Texas, 2013. Subject 11, Reinhardt William J., born April 9, 1987, Jefferson City, Missouri. Sentenced to death for three counts of capital murder and aggravated sexual assault, Miami-Dade County, Florida, 2012. Subject 10, Martinez, Julio A., born May 3, 1991, El Paso, Texas. Sentenced to death for the capital murder of a peace officer, Laramie County, Wyoming, 2011. Subject 9, Lambright, Horace D., born October 19, 1992, Oglala, South Dakota. Sentenced to death for two counts of capital murder and aggravated sexual assault, Maricopa County, Arizona, 2014. Subject 8. Eccles, Martin S. Born June 15, 1984, Everett, Washington. Sentenced to death for capital murder and armed robbery, Cameron Parish, Louisiana, 2012. Subject 7. Sosa, Rupert I. Born August 22, 1989, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Sentenced to death for one count of vehicular homicide with depraved indifference, Lake County, Indiana, 2009. Subject 6. Winston, David D. Born April 1, 1994, Bloomington, Minnesota. Sentenced to death for one count of capital murder and three counts of aggravated sexual assault, Newcastle County, Delaware, 2014. Subject 5. Terrell, Thaddeus R. Born December 26, 1990, New Orleans, Louisiana. Sentenced to death for the capital murder of a Homeland Security officer, New Orleans Federal Housing District, 2014. Subject 4. Baffis, John T. Born February 12, 1992, Orlando, Florida. Sentenced to death for one count of capital murder and one count of second-degree murder with depraved indifference, Pasco County, Florida, 2010. Subject 3. Chavez, Victor Y. Born July 5, 1995, Niagara Falls, New York. Sentenced to death for one count of capital murder and two counts of aggravated sexual assault with a minor, Elko County, Nevada, 2012. Subject 2. Morrison, Joseph P. Born January 9, 1992, Black Creek, Kentucky. Sentenced to death for one count of capital murder, Lewis County, Kentucky, 2013. And, finally, Subject 1. Babcock, Giles J. Born October 29, 1994, Desert Wells, Nevada. Sentenced to death for one count of capital murder, Nye County, Nevada, 2013. Babcock, he thought. Desert Wells. They always go home. Amy's file was thinner than the others. Subject 13, Amy N.L.N., the label read. Convent of the Sisters of Mercy, Memphis, Tennessee. Height and weight and hair color and a string of numbers that Peter surmised were medical data of the kind Michael had found on the chip in her neck. Affixed to this page was a photograph of a little girl, no more than 6 years old, just as Michael had predicted. All knees and elbows, sitting on a wooden chair, dark hair falling around her face. Peter had never before seen a photograph of someone he'd actually known, and for a moment his mind struggled to comprehend the notion that this image was the same person who was sleeping in the next room. But there was no question. Her eyes were Amy's eyes. "See," her eyes seemed to say. "Who did you think I was?" He came to the file for Walgast, Bradford J. There was no photograph. A rusty stain on the top page showed where one had once been clipped. But even without it, Peter was able to form a picture in his mind of this man who, if what Lacey said was true, had brought each of the 12 to the compound. And Amy as well. A tall, sturdy man with deep-set eyes and graying hair, with large hands good for work. A mild face, but troubled. Something moving under the surface, barely contained. According to the file, Walgast had been married and had had a child. The girl, whose name was Eva, was listed as deceased. Peter wondered if that was the reason he had decided in the end to help Amy. His instincts told him it was. It was the contents of the last file, though, that told him the most. A report by someone named Cole to a Colonel Sykes, U.S. Army Division of Special Weapons, concerning the work of a Dr. Jonas Lear and something called Project Noah. And a second document, dated 5 years later, ordering the transfer of 12 human test subjects from Telluride, Colorado, to White Sands, New Mexico, for operational combat testing. It took Peter a while to put the pieces together. Or mostly. But he knew what combat was. All those years, he thought, waiting for the army to return. And it was the army that had done it. As he put down the final file, he heard Lacey rising. She passed through the curtain and stopped in the doorway.
"So, you have read."
At the sound of her voice, a sudden exhaustion washed over him. Lacey restoked the fire and sat at the table across from him. He gestured over the piles of paper on the table.
"He really did this?"
"The doctor."
"Yes."
She nodded.
"There were others, but yes."
"Did he ever say why?" Behind her, the fresh logs caught with a soft whoomp, blazing the room with light.
"I think because he could. That is the reason for most things people do. He was not a bad man, Peter. It was not entirely his fault, though he believed it was. Many times I asked him, 'Do you think the world could be unmade by men alone?' Of course it could not. But he never quite believed me."
She tipped her head toward the files on the table.
"He left these for you, you know."
"Me? How could he have left them for me?"
"For whoever came back. So they would know what happened here."
He sat quietly, uncertain what to say. Alicia had been right about one thing. All his life, since the day he had come out of the sanctuary, he had wondered why the world was what it was. But learning the truth had solved nothing. Amy's stuffed rabbit was still on the table. He took it in his hand.
"Do you think she remembers it?"
"What they did to her? I do not know. Perhaps she does."
"No. I meant before. Being a girl."
He searched for the words.
"Being human. I think that she has always been human."
He waited for Lacey to say more, and when she didn't, he put the rabbit aside.
"What's it like, living forever?"
She gave a sudden laugh.
"I do not think that I will live forever."
"But he gave you the virus.
You're like her. Like Amy." "There is no one like Amy, Peter."
She shrugged.
But if you are asking what it has been like for me all these years, since Jonas died, I will say that it has been very lonely. It surprises me how much.
You miss him, don't you? He instantly regretted saying this. A look of sadness swept over her face, like the shadow of a bird crossing a field. I'm sorry, I didn't mean... But she shook her head.
No.
It is perfectly all right that you should ask. It is difficult to talk about him like this after so long. But the answer is yes. I do miss him. I should think it a wonderful thing to be missed. The way that I miss him.
For a while they sat in silence, bathed in the glow of the fire. Peter wondered if Alicia was thinking about him, where she was now. He had no idea if he would see her or any of them again.
I don't know what I'm doing, Lacey, he said finally. I don't know what to do with any of this.
You found your way here. That is something. That is a beginning.
What about Amy?
What about her, Peter?
But he wasn't sure what he was asking. The question was what it was. What of Amy?
I thought...
He sighed and drew his gaze away toward the room where Amy slept.
Listen to me.
I don't know what I thought.
That you could defeat them? That you would find the answer here?
Yes. He returned his eyes to Lacey. I didn't even know I was thinking it until just now. But yes. Lacey appeared to be studying him, though what she was looking for Peter couldn't say. He wondered if he was as crazy as he sounded. Probably he was.
Tell me, Peter, do you know the story of Noah?
Not Project Noah. Noah the man.
The name was nothing he knew. I don't think so.
It is an old story. A true story. I think it will be some help to you.
Lacey rose a little in her chair, her face suddenly animated.
So, a man named Noah was asked by God to build a ship, a great ship. This was long ago. Why would I build a ship? Noah asked. It is a sunny day. I have other things to do. Because this world has grown wicked, God said to him, and it is my intention to send a flood of water to destroy it and drown every living thing. But you, Noah, are a man righteous in your generation, and I will save you and your family if you do as I command, building this ship to carry yourselves and every species of animal, two of every kind. And do you know what Noah did, Peter?
He built the ship. Her eyes widened.
Of course he did. But not right away. That, you see, is the interesting part of the story. If Noah had simply done as he was told, the story wouldn't mean anything at all. No. He was afraid that people would make fun of him. He was afraid he would build the ship and the flood wouldn't come and he would look like a fool. God was testing him, you see, to find out if there was anyone who made the world worth saving. He wanted to see if Noah was up to the job. And in the end, he was. He built the ship, and the heavens opened, and the world was washed away. For a long time Noah and his family floated on the waters. It seemed they had been forgotten, that a terrible joke had been played on them. But after many days, God remembered Noah and sent him a dove to lead them to dry land. And the world was reborn.
She gave her hands a quiet clap of satisfaction.
There. You see?
He didn't. Not at all. It reminded him of the fables teacher had read to them in circle, stories of talking animals that always ended in a lesson. Pleasant to listen to, and maybe not wrong, but in the end too easy. Something for children.
You do not believe me.
That is all right. One day you will.
It's not that I don't believe you, Peter managed. I'm sorry. It's just that it's only a story.
Perhaps,
she shrugged.
And perhaps someday someone will say those very words about you, Peter. What do you say to that?
He didn't know. It was late, or early. The night was almost gone. Despite all he had learned, he felt more puzzled than when it had begun. So, for the sake of argument, he said, if I'm supposed to be Noah, then who's Amy?
Lacey's face was incredulous. She seemed about to laugh.
Peter, I am surprised at you. Perhaps I did not tell it right.
No, you told it fine, he assured her.
I just don't know.
She leaned forward in her chair and smiled again, one of her strange, sad smiles, full of belief.
The ship, Peter, said Lacey. Amy is the ship.
Peter was still trying to make sense of this mysterious answer when Lacey seemed to startle. Frowning sharply, she darted her eyes around the room.
Lacey, what's wrong? But she seemed not to have heard him. She briskly pushed away from the table.
I have gone on too long, I'm afraid. It will be light soon. Go and wake her now, and gather your things.
He was taken aback, his mind still drifting in the night's strange currents.
We're leaving?
He rose to discover Amy standing in the doorway to the bedroom, her dark hair wild and askew, the curtain shifting behind her. Whatever had affected Lacey had affected her also. Her face was lit with a sudden urgency.
Lacey, Amy began. I know. He will try to be here before daybreak.
Drawing on her cloak, Lacey gave her insistent gaze to Peter once more.
Hurry now.
The peace of the night was suddenly banished, replaced by a sense of emergency his mind could not seem to grasp.
Lacey, who are you talking about? Who's coming?
But then he looked at Amy, and he knew.
Babcock.
Babcock was coming.
Quickly, Peter.
Lacey, you don't understand.
He felt weightless, benumbed. He had nothing to fight with, not even a blade.
We're totally unarmed. I've seen what he can do.
There are weapons more powerful than guns and knives, the woman replied.
Her face held no fear, only a sense of purpose.
It is time for you to see it.
See what?
What you came to find, said Lacey. The passage.
Chapter 68. Peter in darkness. Lacey was leading them away from the house into the woods. A frigid wind was blowing through the trees, a ghostly moaning. A rind of moon had ascended, bathing the scene in a trembling light, making the shadows lurch and sway around him. They ascended a ridge and descended another. The snow was deep here, blown into drifts with a hard carapace of crust. They were on the south side of the mountain now. Peter heard below him the sound of the river. He felt it before he saw it, a vastness of space opening before him, the mountain falling away. He reached out reflexively to find Amy, but she was gone. The edge could be anywhere. One wrong step and the darkness would swallow him.
This way,
Lacey called from ahead.
Hurry, hurry!
He followed the sound of her voice. What he thought was a sheer drop was actually a rocky decline, steep but passable. Amy was already moving down the twisting path. He took a breath of icy air, willing his fear away, and followed. The path grew narrower, running horizontally to the mountain's face as it descended, clinging to it like a catwalk. To his left, sheer rock, glinting with moonlit ice. To his right, an abyss of blackness, a plunge into nothing. Even to look at it was to be swept away. He kept his eyes forward. The women were moving quickly, shadowy presences leaping at the far edge of his vision. Where was Lacey taking them? What was the weapon she had spoken of? He could hear the voice of the river again far below. The stars shone hard and pure above his face, like chips of ice. He turned a corner and stopped. Lacey and Amy were standing before a wide, pipe-like opening in the mountain's face. The hole was as tall as he was, its depthless interior a maw of blackness.
"This way," said Lacey.
2 steps, 3 steps, 4. The darkness enveloped him. Lacey was taking them inside the mountain. He remembered the tin of matches in his coat. He stopped and struck one, his insensate fingers fumbling in the cold, but as soon as it sparked, the swirling currents of air puffed the flame away. Lacey's voice from up ahead.
"Hurry, Peter!"
He inched his way forward, each step an act of faith. Then he felt a hand on his arm, a firm pressure. Amy.
"Stop!"
He couldn't see anything at all. Despite the cold, he had begun to sweat under his parka. Where was Lacey? He had spun around, searching for the opening to orient himself, when from behind him came a squeal of metal and the sound of an opening door. Everything blazed with light. They were in a long hallway carved from the mountain. The walls were lined with pipes and metal conduits. Lacey was standing at a breaker panel on the wall adjacent to the entrance. The room was illuminated by a bank of buzzing fluorescent lights high above.
"There's power?"
"Batteries. The doctor showed me how." "No batteries could last this long."
"These are different."
Lacey swung the heavy door closed behind them.
"He called it level 5. I will show you. Please come."
The hallway led to a wider space, sunk in darkness. Lacey moved along the wall to find the switch. Through the soles of his wet boots he could feel a kind of humming, distinctly mechanical. The lights buzzed and flickered to life. The room appeared to be some kind of infirmary. An air of abandonment hung over all. The gurney and the long, tall counter covered with dusty equipment, burners and beakers and chrome basins tarnished with age. A tray of syringes, still sealed in plastic, and resting on a long, rust-stained shawl of fabric, a line of metal probes and scalpels. At the back of the room, in a nest of conduits, was what appeared to be a battery stack. "If you found her, bring her here." Here, Peter thought. Not just the mountain, but here. This room. What was here? Lacey had stepped to a steel case, like a wardrobe, bolted to the wall. On its face was a handle, and beside this, a keypad. He watched as the woman punched in a long series of numbers, then turned the handle with a thunk. He thought at first the case was empty. Then he saw, resting on the bottom shelf, a metal box. Lacey removed it and passed it to him. The box, small enough to fit in one hand, was surprisingly light. It appeared to have no seams at all, but there was a latch with a tiny button beside it that perfectly fit his thumb. Peter pressed it. At once the box separated into 2 perfectly formed halves. Inside, cradled in foam, lay 2 rows of tiny glass vials containing a shimmering green liquid. He counted 11. A 12th compartment was empty.
"It is the last virus," said Lacey. "The one he gave to Amy. He made it from her blood."
He searched her face to see the truth registered there. But he already knew the truth. More than that, he felt the truth. The empty one. That's you, isn't it? The one Lear gave you. Lacey nodded.
I believe that it is.
He closed the lid, which sealed with a solid click. He slid off his backpack and pulled out a blanket, which he used to wrap the box, then placed it all inside. From the counter he retrieved a handful of the sealed syringes and put these in the pack as well. Their best chance was to make it through till dawn, then get down the mountain. After that, he didn't know. He turned to Amy. How long do we have? She shook her head. Not long.
He's close.
Can he get through that door, Lacey? The woman said nothing. Lacey!
It is my hope that he will, she said.
They were in the field now, high above the river. Peter's and Amy's trail had disappeared, covered by the blowing snow. Alicia had ridden ahead. It should have been dawn by now, thought Michael, but all he saw was the same gray softening they'd been riding toward for what seemed like hours. "So where the hell are they?" said Hollis. Michael didn't know if he meant Peter and Amy or the Virals. The thought occurred to him, with a vague acceptance, that they were all going to die up here, that none of them would ever leave this frozen, barren place. Sarah and Greer were silent, thinking the same thing, Michael thought, or maybe they were just too cold to speak. His hands were so stiff he doubted he could fire, much less reload his rifle. He tried to take a drink from his canteen to steady himself, but it was frozen solid. From out of the darkness they heard the sound of Alicia's horse, riding back at a trot. She pulled up beside them. "Tracks," she said, gesturing with a quick tip of her head. "There's an opening in the fence." She heeled her mount, not waiting for them, and barreled back the way she'd come. Without a word, Greer followed, the others bringing up the rear. They were in the trees again. Alicia was riding faster now, galloping through the snow. Michael heeled his mount, urging the animal forward. Beside him, Sarah bent her neck low over her mount as the branches skimmed past. Something was moving above them, in the trees. Michael lifted his face in time to hear a gun go off behind him. No sooner had this happened than a violent force slapped him from the rear, shoving the air from his lungs and catapulting him headfirst over the horse's neck, his rifle swinging out from his hand like a whip. For a single instant he felt himself suspended painlessly over the earth. Part of his mind paused to register this surprising fact, but the sensation didn't last. He hit the ground with a jolt, landing on his back in the snow, and now there were other things to think about. He had, he saw, come to rest directly in the path of his own horse. He rolled over on his side, covering the back of his head with his hands as if this might actually help. He felt the wild torrent of air as the panicked animal bounded over him, followed by the concussion of its hooves, one impacting just inches from his ear. Then it was gone. Everyone was gone. Michael saw the Viral, the same one he surmised that had knocked him from his horse as soon as he drew up to his knees. It was crouched just a few meters from him, poised on its folded haunches like a frog. Its forearms were buried in the snow, which glowed with the organic light of its bioluminescence, as if the creature were partially immersed in a pool of blue-green water. More snow clung to its chest and arms, a glistening dust. Rivulets of moisture were running down its face. Michael realized that he was hearing gunshots, an echoing spatter over the ridge, and mixed with this, like the words of a song, voices calling his name. But these sounds might have been signals from a distant star, like the vast expanse of darkness around him, for that too had faded from his mind, dispersing like the molecules of an expanding gas. They might have pertained to some other person entirely. The Viral was clicking now, rocking the muscles of its jaw. With a cock of its head, it gave a lazy-seeming snap of teeth, as if it were in no hurry, as if the two of them had all the time in the world. And in that moment, Michael realized that the place where he kept his fear was empty. He Michael the Circuit, wasn't afraid. What he felt was more like anger, a huge, weary irritation, such as he might have felt for a fly that had been buzzing around his face too long. God damn it, he thought, guiding his hand to the sheath on his belt. I am so tired of these fucking things. Maybe there are 40 million of you and maybe there aren't. In the next 2 seconds, there's going to be one less. As Michael rose, the viral shot forward, its arms and legs extending like the fingers of an open hand. He barely had enough time to shove the blade out in front of him, his eyes closing reflexively. He felt the bite of metal as the viral slammed into him, folding over Michael's body as he tumbled backward. He rolled to see the viral lying face up on the snow. His blade was buried in its chest. Its arms and legs were making a kind of paddling motion, clawing at the air. A pair of figures were standing above the body. Peter, and beside him, Amy. Where had they come from? Amy was holding a rifle. Michael's rifle, covered in snow. At their feet, the creature made a sound that could have been a sigh or a groan. Amy drew the stock of the gun to her shoulder, lowered the barrel, and pushed it into the viral's open mouth. I'm sorry, she said, and pulled the trigger. Michael rose to his feet. The viral was motionless now, its agonal twitchings ceased. A broad spray of blood lay on the snow. Amy passed the gun to Peter. Take this. Are you okay? Peter asked Michael. Only then did Michael realize he was shaking. He nodded. Come on. They heard more gunfire over the ridge. They ran. It wasn't fair, Lacey knew, what she had done. Allowing Peter and Amy to think that she would be going with them. Setting the bomb's timer and leading them to the door to the tunnel, then directing them to stand on the far side. Pulling the door closed as they watched, then dropping the bolts in place. She could hear them banging on the other side, could hear Amy's voice a final time ringing in her mind. Lacey, Lacey, don't go. Run now. He will be here any minute. Lacey, please. You must help them. They'll be afraid. They won't know what is happening. Help them, Amy. All that had happened here, in this place, needed to be wiped away. As God had wiped the earth away in the days of Noah, so that the great ship could sail and make the world again, she would be his waters. Such a terrible thing, the bomb. It was small, Jonas had explained, just half a kiloton. Large enough to destroy the chalet itself, all its underground floors, to hide the evidence of what they had done, but not so large as to register on any satellites. A failsafe, in case the virals had ever broken out. But then the power had failed on the upper levels, and Sykes was gone or dead, and though Jonas could have detonated it himself, he could not bring himself to do this. Not with Amy there. With Peter and Amy watching, Lacey had knelt before it. A small, suitcase-shaped object with the dull finish of all military things. Jonas had shown her the steps. She pressed a small indent on the side and a panel dropped down, revealing a keyboard with a small screen, large enough for a single line of text. She typed, Elizabeth. The screen flickered to life. Arm? Y, N. She pressed Y. Time? For a moment she paused. Then she typed 5. 5 minutes. Confirm. Y, N. She pressed Y once more. On the screen, a clock began to run. 4:59. 4:58. 4:57. She sealed the panel and rose. Quickly, she had said to the two of them, leading them briskly down the hall. We must get out of here now. Then she'd locked them out. Lacey, please. I don't know what to do.
tell me what to do.
You will, Amy, when the moment comes. You will know what is inside you then. You will know how to set them free, to make their final passage.
Now she was alone. Her work was nearly done. When she was certain Peter and Amy were gone, she freed the bolts and opened the door wide.
Come to me, she thought.
Standing in the doorway, she breathed deeply, composing herself, sending out her mind.
Come to the place where you were made.
Lacey waited. 5 minutes. After so many years, it seemed like nothing. Because it really was.
Dawn was breaking over the mountain. The three of them were racing toward the shots. They crested a ridge. Below them, Michael saw a house, the horses outside. Sarah and Alicia were waving to them from the door. The creatures were behind them now in the trees. They tore down the embankment and dashed inside. Greer and Hollis appeared from behind a curtain, carrying a tall chest of drawers.
They're right behind us, Michael said.
They wedged the bureau against the door. A hopeless gesture, thought Michael, but it might buy them a second or two.
What about these windows? Alicia was saying. Anything we can use?
They tried to move the cupboard, but it was too heavy.
Forget it, Alicia said.
She drew a pistol from her waistband and pressed it into Michael's hands.
Greer, you and Hollis take the window in the bedroom. Everyone else stays here. Two on the door, one on each window, front and back. Circuit, you watch the chimney. They'll go for the horses first.
Everyone took their positions. From the bedroom, Hollis shouted, "Here they come!" Something was wrong, Lacey thought. They should have been here by now. She could feel them everywhere around her, filling her mind with their hunger and the question,
"Who am I? Who am I? Who am I?"
She stepped into the tunnel.
"Come to me," she answered. "Come to me. Come to me."
She moved quickly down its length. She could make out the opening, a circle of softening gray, the elongated dawn of the mountain. The first true light of sunrise would hit them from the west, reflecting off the far side of the valley, its fields of snow and ice. She reached the tunnel's mouth and stepped out. She could see below her the tracks and debris of the viral's ascent up the icy slope. 1,000 strong and more. They had gone right past. Despair gripped her.
"Where are you?" she thought,
and then she said it, hearing the fury in her voice as it echoed over the valley.
"Where are you?"
But there was silence from heaven.